Chapter 3. Babel Fell. Al! Alphonse! Over here! Winry waves her hands at the train station platform, trying to get her friend's attention. He turns to her, and she falters. It's hard for a suit of armor to look devastated, but he does. She doesn't know what she was expecting, exactly, but the stiff, tense-shouldered walk over to her makes her think it's worse than anything she was imagining. People are moving out of his way as he walks to her, giving him fearful glances, which is strange. Al always looks scary, but people are rarely scared. He finally makes it over to her, and she reaches for his hand, grabbing one of his massive ones between her own. He's clenched both of them into fists. What's wrong? Is Ed okay? It's a stupid question, because if Ed wasn't okay, Al wouldn't be here. He pushes his other fist in front of her face, and there's a crumpled letter there. She reaches for it, and it takes a bit of tugging to get it away from him. She smooths it out and instantly recognizes Ed's handwriting. It's in their code, which is irritating, but she's penned enough letters for Al to Ed before he'd gotten used to his fingers that she can read it, if slowly. They stand there in silence for several long minutes as she reads, forcing people to move around them. But everyone is too cowed by Al's presence to tell them to leave. She's crying by the time she finishes, and she looks up at him, eyes wide. Yes, Al says, and his voice is brimming with all the tears he can't shed. I have to go to Dublith. I'm going to get on the next train. I just didn't want to leave without telling you. I'm coming with you. Are you crazy? She asks. You're not doing this alone. It's dangerous, he says quietly. I don't want you to get hurt. She glares. Life is dangerous, Alphonse. Get over it. I'm coming with you. Winry grabs his apron and tugs, intent on having him follow her home. After a moment of stubbornness, he relents and allows her to drag him through the train station. She has a lot of work lined up. She'll have to find other mechanics to handle her clients when she's gone. The loss of custom is going to suck, but with any luck, she'll get it handled with a few calls, and they can be in Dublith by nightfall. Plus, she's kind of worried about Rush Valley losing access to one of its only actual doctors, but it's unavoidable. Ed and Al only ever manage to get in more trouble when she's not there to pull them out of it. Aviv wakes up slowly, the sun shining through the window and onto his face. That's strange, because usually he's left for the office by the time the sun's up. Then he remembers it's Saturday, and curls more into his bed, sighing. He reaches out a hand for Gabby, intent on pulling her closer and enjoying a rare, lazy morning. The space beside him is empty and cold, and he's disappointed, but not surprised. She gets up early every morning to work on her translations, even on the weekends. She gets paid by the line translated, not by how many hours she works, so he can rarely get her to take a break. He pushes himself up, idly wondering what he should make for breakfast, and if she's already made coffee. When he gets a good look at his hands, is that dirt under his fingernails? When would that have happened? All at once, the events of yesterday come rushing back. It's not dirt, it's blood. Saif's blood. He runs from their bedroom, heart pounding, not sure exactly what he's afraid of, but knowing he is afraid. Gabby? Gabby? Aviv grabs the edge of the doorframe, looking into the open living room and kitchen. Gabby is at the stove, midway through cooking a large pot of oatmeal. She turns to face him, frowning. What? Is something wrong? Saif is sitting on the couch, wearing Aviv's clothes, since his were covered in blood, and looking through a large stack of papers, his eyebrows pulled together as he concentrates. It's one of the passages from an ancient Ishvalan monk's personal journal that Gabby has been translating. As a monk himself, Saif is one of the few people left who was taught the ancient holy scripture by the masters. He's not surprised at all that Gabby has roped him into double-checking her translations. Aviv looks up, and his mouth quirks up at the corners. "It seems you have grown up," he says in Ishvalan. Gabby snorts, and Aviv has no idea what he's talking about, until he realizes he's standing there completely naked. "Ishvala above!" he curses, and hurries back into their room to find a pair of pants. Saif and Gabby's laughter follow him down the hall, and he can't help but let a smile tug at the corner of his lips. Ed is conflicted about where to go after he parts ways with Lust. His head is buzzing with information, and what he wants to do is go somewhere to have a panic attack, or at least think things through. There's no time for that now. First things first, he should really go get his coat. But he left it with Chris, and he tries to avoid going to Canal Street during the day. It's only asking for trouble, and he has quite enough of that already. But he'll be at Hughes's at night, so unless he wants to wait until tomorrow night to go grab it, he might as well head over there now. Oh well, if the rumor mill decides he's picked up a fondness for drug trafficking, they might at least talk a little bit less about how he's supposedly spreading his legs for his commanding officer. He isn't particularly bothered by those rumors, but Roy gets a pinched look around his eyes whenever they come up. It's a quick trip, what with him being one of the few people interested in going there in the light of day. Chris's place is open, but quiet. Most of the girls still asleep, resting from a long night of work. Vanessa is there, with her head in the accounts book. She's not made up like she is for the night crowd. No heavy makeup or short, tight dress. Her hair is pulled up, and she's in jeans and a tank top, and he laughs out loud, and her head jerks up, and then she grins. "Do you like it?" she asks, stepping out from behind the bar to twirl. She's wearing his red coat, and it flares up around her. It's almost comical on her, too big around the shoulders, and she has lots of space around her waist. "Perfect," he says. "Suits you." "I suppose you'll be wanting it back." She shrugs it off, holding it out to him. Then her eyes narrow. "You look like crap. Didn't the madame only give you 2 drinks? He had transmuted his tank top into a long sleeve shirt this morning, but the material had become so thin in response it almost seemed pointless. With a clap, he's back to his classic tank, and he gratefully pulls his coat back on. "It was closer to 12, but it wasn't her fault. I've just had a weird couple of days." Vanessa hums, leaning over the bar to grab and tug on a dark sweater that he's almost certain he left here on accident a couple of months ago. He doesn't understand her obsession with stealing his clothes. "Want breakfast? I can probably manage to cook us something without setting the house on fire." "It's past noon," he points out, even though he hasn't eaten yet either, now that he thinks about it. "I should probably get going. I've got a busy day." He starts to walk away, but Vanessa reaches out and grabs his wrist in a vice-like grip. He's thankful it's the automail one, otherwise it probably would have hurt. "That wasn't a request. You look like shit, and if anything happens to you, the madame will throw a fit. Now come on, I'll make coffee." "So pushy," he grumbles, but doesn't fight her. He's on the fence about her cooking ability, but she makes great coffee. "Hey, did you know that Chris is Roy's mom?" "You didn't?" she asks, trying to sound appalled, but not doing nearly a good enough job to hide her delight. "Oh, have I got some stories for you?" What's left of his reluctance dissolves away, for the promise of embarrassing stories about Roy and coffee and not having to think for just a little bit, he can put everything else off. It's probably not the most responsible decision, but he feels like he'll drown if he doesn't stop and catch his breath. "Okay," he says, and follows her through the double swinging doors and into the kitchen. When Mace answers the door and finds Roy on the other side, he's immediately concerned. "Did something happen? Is everything okay?" "I don't know," he says blankly. "Ed told me to be here at 6. Is he not here?" That's not comforting at all. No, he sighs. But I guess he'll show up. Want to join us for dinner? Gracia always makes too much for just the four of us. I can head back home if it's too much trouble. You can just ring me when Ed shows up, he says. Mace shakes his head and steps aside to gesture Roy inside. No, stay, I insist. Besides, if Ed has decided we need a random meeting in the middle of the night, then it's probably important enough for us to wait around for him. I think Nina had some alchemy questions for you anyway. Nina's understanding of alchemy outstripped mine a couple of years ago, he says dryly, but I appreciate her efforts to make me feel as if I'm not completely useless. His daughters are delighted with their godfather's unexpected appearance. Alicia insists on sitting in his lap, and Nina pulls him into a conversation of elemental symbolism that outstrips Mace's limited understanding of alchemy about 30 seconds in. Halfway through their plates, they both abandon eating and instead are arguing about the correct way to balance a circle. Alicia slips off Roy's lap, darts into the living room, and then comes back holding a fistful of crayons in one hand and a bunch of paper in the other. Drawing helps, she says, dropping the items onto the table in front of them.
Thanks, Alicia,
they say in unison. Then each of them start drawing out their circles. Alicia has decided she doesn't want to get in the middle of that and climbs onto Mace's lap instead. He shares an amused look with Gracia. They always get like this, she says, absently trying to get Alicia to eat her own portion of carrots. Mace has no idea why she keeps making them, considering she dislikes them so much. He means to respond, but there's the sound of their front door opening and shutting, and then uneven footsteps.
Big brother!
Alicia screeches. She scrambles off his lap, accidentally kneeing him in the groin in the process. Will that boy ever learn to knock? Roy asks, not looking up from his paper. The intensity of it is ruined, since he's holding a bright pink crayon. Gracia pops a fork full of carrots into her mouth, grimacing as she swallows it. Don't be silly. He hardly needs to knock to enter his own home. That makes a strange look go over Roy's face, and Mace just knows he's thinking about how casually Ed enters his home all the time. If Nina wasn't sitting right there, he'd absolutely make fun of him for it. Ed enters the dining room with Alicia on his hip.
Sorry, I was at Chris's and lost track of time.
I see you got your coat back, Roy says. Mace blinks. Did Ed mean Chris, as in Madam Christmas? Roy's mother?
Vanessa says hello.
Ed's grin looks almost feral.
We had a great time talking about you.
Roy looks like he wants to die, and Gracia has a sudden coughing fit that she's doing her best to pretend isn't because she's choking on her own laughter. She isn't doing a very good job.
Brother, tell Uncle Roy he's wrong, Nina commands.
You're wrong, Ed tells Roy instantly, walking to the edge of the table so he can peer at both of their circles. Nina and Roy have been arguing and scribbling over their circles for the better part of an hour, but Ed spends perhaps half a minute looking them over before he says,
They're both functional. Roy's is more elegant, but his attention to balancing the circle means that he loses a lot of energy in his reaction. Nina, your circle is more effective, but there's more room for error because it's unbalanced. If you used this circle and lost control of it,
I wouldn't, she says,
and Mace hasn't seen this particular mixture of arrogance and confidence in a kid since Ed was that age.
Balancing circles are a waste of time. If the science is there, all you have to do is not lose control of the energy until the reaction is complete.
Roy is staring at Nina in horror. He does that a lot. Ed sighs.
You say that, then a reaction gets out of control and you're facing an alchemical backlash that leaves you scarred for life if you're lucky.
Mace's heart rate ticks up, because he's seen the horrible things alchemy does to the people who think they can control it, and fail. He wishes, not for the first time, that Nina was invested in something less dangerous, something that wouldn't keep him up at night so often. But there's nothing for it. Alchemy is as necessary to Nina as it is to Ed and Al.
It's as necessary as breathing. He won't suffocate her just because he's scared. He won't. Ed plucks the pink crayon from Roy's hand and flips Nina's paper over, sketching out another circle in easy, precise movements. When he's done, Roy and Nina basically shove him out of the way to get a better look at it. Ed rolls his eyes and retreats to the other side of the table. He's still holding Alicia on his hip, and she'd undone his braid and is clumsily trying to rebraid it on her own. It's not her most successful endeavor. "Hey, Gracia. Sorry for dropping in," he says, casually reaching over to claim her carrots for his own. Gracia gratefully pushes her plate in his direction. Mace thinks about saying for roughly the 1,000th time that if she dislikes them so much, then she doesn't have to make them. Then considers that she's about as apt to listen to him this time around as she has been all the times before, which means she'll ignore him completely. So he continues to say nothing. "Not at all," she says warmly. "You are always welcome here, Edward. You know that." He grins and flushes. Whatever he might have said to that is interrupted by Nina smacking her head against the table, and Roy letting out a loud groan. They're still hovering above Ed's circle.
Why didn't I think of that?
His daughter and his best friend exclaim at the same time. Ed is cackling, and Mace takes a moment to consider what's more heart attack inducing, Nina growing up to be like Ed or like Roy? With any luck, she'll grow up to be like Hawkeye.
Ever the conscientious military wife, Gracia pulls the girls to bed as soon as dinner is over so they can talk alone. Or tries to. They both refuse to settle until Ed tucks them in himself and tells them a bedtime story. It's actually a code for turning coal into gold, which is why Nina likes it. But on the surface, it's a story of lions and dragons, which is why Alicia likes it. But eventually he's alone with Roy and Mace in the living room, and there's nothing for him to do but tell them what happened. He gets to the part about leaving Scar, or Saif, as he's actually called, to go chase after a woman with knives for fingers, and Mace's mouth falls open. "Scar attacked you, and you just left him? Ed, he's dangerous." He blinks, nonplussed. "Not as dangerous as a homunculus."
"A homunculus?" Roy repeats faintly. "Those aren't real."
He sounds more resigned than disbelieving, which Edward supposes is only inevitable after spending 5 years reading his mission reports. "Don't worry, Scar won't be an issue anymore. Gabby will be mad if he goes on a killing spree while he's staying with her," he says in his most reasonable tone of voice. Roy buries his head in his hands. Mace looks like he wants to tear his hair out.
"Scar is staying with Catherine. Why? Alex will murder me if anything happens to his little sister."
Ed raises an eyebrow. "Don't call her that. She doesn't like it. Besides, she's more than capable of defending herself, even without alchemy."
"Scar's killed several dozen armed men," Roy says, though it comes out kind of muffled since he still has his face in his hands.
If it was Gabby against several dozen armed men, his money would still be on Gabby. "Whatever," he says. "Scar is Aviv's brother-in-law, so I'm sure he'll behave."
"What?" Roy and Mace say in unison.
It's so nice to witness other people going through this emotional roller coaster rather than going through it himself.
"Scar's brother married Layla. Layla was Aviv's older sister. Layla died, and Scar's brother used her remains to create the homunculus lust. Make sense?" he tacks on, just to watch the way their shoulders slump in defeat. They stay up late in the night, going over everything, and Ed feels like he's told the story 100 times by the end of the night. He tells them almost everything. He doesn't mention anything about Sloth, about his mother. Out of everything he's telling them, it's the most insane, the most unbelievable, the most terrifying. He'll save it for when he has something more than hope. It's nearing 3 a.m. by the time they're done, and when he and Roy step outside, he's hit by the silence. Mace's neighborhood is quiet, and there's nothing to disturb it, just the soft sound of their breathing in the night. Can I take you somewhere? Roy asks. I'm hoping you didn't plan to walk.
He risks a glance over, and it's unfortunate how good Roy looks in the moonlight.
Yeah, can you take me to the dorms?
His shoulders drop an inch, and Ed has to bite his lip not to laugh at him.
Of course, Edward.
Give me like 5 minutes to pack up my shit, he adds. Then we can go back to yours. Ed hopes Roy has a better poker face around people he doesn't trust. He supposes he must. Otherwise, he'd be dead by now.
Oh?
Your bed is comfier than the dorms, he says. Besides, we can't let all those rumors of me sleeping my way to the top lapse. They're almost as useful as the one about me blowing up a mountain out of spite.
You did blow up a mountain out of spite, Roy says wryly,
a guiding hand on the small of Ed's back as he walks them to his car. Ed hardly needs it, but he's not about to pull away either.
I did, didn't I? It's so convenient when the rumors we're trying to spread and the truth are the same thing.
This time he can't stop himself from laughing when Roy's whole face turns red in the weak light of the moon.
The train to Doubleth seems to take forever. It's late, so Al charms a couple of thick blankets out of one of the train attendants. Just because he doesn't sleep doesn't mean he's forgotten that other people do. He hands both blankets to Winry, who's been dropping for the past hour, and her face lights up. She lifts his arm and bunches one of the blankets up against his side. Then she wraps the remaining blanket around herself and pulls Al's arm on top of her, so she's snuggled into his side, but not lying against cold, hard metal, and is asleep almost instantly. If Al could blush, he would be. He knows Winry is pretty, knows she's actually what most people would call drop-dead gorgeous. Brother doesn't get it, but Al doesn't think that counts, since Brother doesn't even like girls. Al thinks she looks soft, all the gentle curves of her body and her rough mechanic's hands, her sturdy surgeon's hands. He wishes he could feel her, feel the warm weight of her body against his, feel her damp breath on his skin on her every exhale. But he can't. So he watches the countryside pass and tries to imagine what holding Winry will feel like when he has his real body back. They arrive just past dawn, and Winry stretches and it sounds like every bone in her spine cracks.
What a nice nap! Should we go find a hotel?
Al folds the blankets and leaves them on the seat, and then picks up her luggage, nudging Winry out of their compartment and onto the platform.
We should go to teacher.
Already? She asks, frowning.
I thought you would try to avoid her, honestly. I don't want to lie to her, he says. And maybe I could find greed without confronting her, but we're here, and she's my teacher. I should go see her.
On the bright side, he adds on fatalistically,
she won't be able to bruise me in the armor. It's probably for the best that Ed isn't here.
Winry's eyes narrow.
If she tries to hurt you, I'll hit her with my wrench.
He laughs, feeling lighter already.
Probably best you don't try it, but thanks. You stay here, and I'll deal with teacher. If I hurry, I can get there just as Sig opens the shop, before it gets too busy, and I'll be back in no time.
Roy opens his eyes slowly, squinting against the sunlight pouring into his bedroom. It's just on this side of too cold, and he huddles deeper into his blankets, eyeing his open window with confusion. He doesn't normally sleep with the window open. Then his eyes catch on a single golden hair stuck to his pillow, and yesterday's events come back to him. All that horrifying information about Scar and homunculi, taking Ed home and offering him the guest bedroom, leaving to get ready for bed as Ed unpacked and settled in. He'd come out of the shower to Ed already asleep in his bed, once again in nothing but his boxers. He wasn't about to be driven from his own home, so he'd done the only reasonable thing he could and gotten into bed as well. Ed had pushed back into his chest, and the automail leg against his had been freezing, but the searing warmth of Ed pressed against the front of his body had absolutely made it worth it. Here he is again, alone after Ed spent the night, and he allows himself 5 seconds of being a crazy person and presses his face in the pillow that Ed has slept on, managing to catch the faint scent of his shampoo buried in the fabric. Then, even though it's Sunday, he gets ready for work, puts on his uniform, and makes his bed. He didn't make it to Colonel by 30 by only working the standard 9-to-5, no matter what his reputation. He goes downstairs and walks into his kitchen and freezes. Ed is sitting at his kitchen table, a veritable mountain of toast in front of him. He's scribbling in a notebook, eyebrows pushed together in concentration. He's in a 2 big white button-up. One, it's clear he stole from Roy's closet. It slides off the side to reveal a tanned, scarred shoulder. Roy wonders if Ed's torturing him on purpose. "Is that every piece of bread that was in the cupboard?" he asks Riley, walking over to snag one of the pieces of toast for himself. Ed sprinkled cinnamon and sugar onto the buttery top, which Roy would admonish him for, but last time he made a comment about Ed's diet, he'd responded that eating healthy was for people that didn't work out 3 hours a day. Ed doesn't look up from his notebook.
"I made coffee, too. Don't bitch. It's not like you have anything else edible. Who taught you to grocery shop? A fasting monk?"
Roy pours himself a cup, giving the milk a suspicious sniff before adding it. Ed drinks his coffee black, but with enough sugar that it's more of a crime against humanity than an actual drink. "If you're going to stay here, people will talk. More than they already do, that is."
"Good. If they're preoccupied gossiping about me whoring my way to the top, they won't look into why I'm hanging around Central, considering I've done that approximately never in the past 5 years. We'll have to come up with some reason to tell people why I'm here, so that they can think it's a lie and that we're covering for our illicit affair," Ed says.
He kind of wants to die. "We can say you're using my library, that you've taken an interest in fire alchemy. If you use some for your next assessment, it'll at least be semi-believable."
"My next assessment isn't for another 3 months, but sure," he snorts. "You're lucky that most people are idiotic and can't just tell your equations from your array. You really are asking for trouble having it stitched on the back of your gloves for everyone to see, you know."
Roy has no idea what he's talking about. He wishes this was an abnormal state of affairs, but when it came to Ed, it's actually the norm.
"What do you mean?"
Ed flips to a new page in his notebook and draws Roy's circle perfectly.
"You're good. Really good. So you only have the most basic array, and you do all the other equations and adjustments in your head. But you still need the basic array that your alchemical equations are based off of in order to get away without needing a new circle for every transmutation. Which means that anyone can figure out your method with a little reverse engineering. Al and I did it once when we were bored on the train."
Equations fill the page, going off of everything from the radius of the circle to the placement of his elements, to their size and their relationship to each other. For the next 20 minutes, Roy stands there silently as Ed works his way back through the array, doing 15 high-level mathematical equations just to get a centimeter closer to the truth. He does months' worth of work in minutes, and there's little consolation in the fact that the first time the brothers did this, it probably took them at least a couple of hours. By the time he's done, he's drawn a complicated array and a set of equations almost identical to the ones on Reese's back.
"This is pretty much it, right?"
"Right," Roy says softly. Before, this would have terrified him, to see the lightning intelligence and raw power Ed commanded through intellect alone. But he knows better now. Knows that Ed could make far more destructive and powerful circles. Knows that he would never use any of them to hurt people or gain power, for anything but the purest reasons. He has to get to work, and Ed needs to do whatever it is he's doing, with the colossal mess he's uncovered. But they spend a long moment standing there, looking at each other, and saying nothing at all. It should feel awkward and heavy, but it doesn't. It feels normal. It feels safe, even. This whole thing really is courting disaster, but Roy can't find it in himself to put a stop to it.
Alphonse doesn't want Winry to get caught in the crossfire, doesn't want her getting hurt trying to defend him, so he's glad that she agreed to stay in the city proper instead of coming with him. But he almost regrets it as he steps into Curtis Butcher's, and is surprised by how much he's smacked in the face with a sense of home, of belonging. They only spent a few short years here, but they were happy, for all that happiness seemed like a betrayal with their mother dead.
"Curtis Butcher's, what can I get for you?" a gruff, suspicious voice asks.
Al spins around so fast he nearly takes out a barrel of sausage.
"Sig!"
It's been nearly a decade, and he's not a little boy anymore. He's a giant suit of armor, so there's no way for Sig to recognize him. But the man's stoic face goes slack with wonder.
"Alphonse?"
And he can't feel it, not really, but he still pushes past the counter to pick him up in a bear hug anyway.
"Sig, I've missed you!"
"I've missed you too," he says,
but his lopsided grin disappears as he takes a closer look under Al's helmet. Al sees the exact moment that he figures out that there's nothing underneath. His whole face closes off, and he says,
"You better go talk to Izumi."
Once Ed finishes working out the array that he thinks should at least theoretically manage to contain a homunculus, he'll have to get Lust to help him test it. Even if just temporarily, he throws on his clothes and leaves Roy's house. He has approximately 1,000 things he could do, that he should go do, but he finds himself walking in the direction of South Central. Considering the mess he left the last time he was over at Gabby's, it seems only right to make a cursory appearance. It would be faster to take a cab, but walking will let him clear his head and will give him time to shake the array from his mind and focus on something else. The walk to Aviv and Gabby's is a lot longer from Roy's house than it is from the military dorms, but it ends up being a good thing because it gives him just enough time to clear his head, to not have alchemical equations on his tongue. Gabby's waiting for him by the time he makes it to their door. As always, able to know he's coming by his uneven stomps as he takes the stairs two at a time, all the way up to the fifth floor. He really wishes they would let him install an elevator.
"Ed,"
she says cheerfully, putting an arm around his shoulders and pulling him inside. "We were getting worried about you. I called the dorms for you, but they said you weren't there."
"Oh, yeah," he says. "Sorry about that. I didn't mean to worry you. I'm not staying in the dorms."
She gives him a narrow-eyed look at that, clearly hearing what he isn't saying. She dislikes Roy slightly less than some other people, but Ed still avoids bringing him up if he can help it. Luckily, Gabby can usually figure out what he means by all the things he doesn't say.
"It's okay, we're just glad you're all right."
She shuts the door behind them, and Ed is struck by the bizarre sight of Saif sitting on the kitchen table, while Aviv stands between his legs, carefully pressing something to his face.
"What are you doing?"
"He cannot stay in our apartment forever," Aviv says, tilting Saif's face up towards the light. Ed gets a better look and realizes he's applying makeup to Saif's skin, slowly covering the distinct crisscross scar over his face. Luckily, his only identifying features are his clothes and his scar, and we can take care of both.
"I'm surprised you're not having Gabby do this," he says, stepping closer to watch Aviv expertly apply the foundation until the scar looks like nothing more than slightly raised skin.
He shrugs. "I have more experience covering scars than she does. I always cover mine for important meetings."
Saif's eyes narrow at that, and he reaches out and grasps Aviv's wrist, stilling his movements. He says in Ishvalan,
"You have nothing to be ashamed of, brother. You do not need to hide your scars."
Aviv's face shifts,
caught between fond exasperation and a strange sort of hesitance. Ed shrugs off his jacket and tosses it on the back of one of the kitchen chairs. I would hide mine if I could. Sometimes it's not about shame. It's just about not wanting people to look at you with pity in their eyes. Saif startles, like he'd forgotten that Ed spoke Ishvalan. His eyes track his automail and the thick, angry scar tissue that peeks out from the neck of his tank top. He nods.
I see.
Are you going to try and kill me? He asks conversationally, absently accepting the mug of hot chocolate Gabby shoves into his hands. The fact that he's not a kid anymore and doesn't need to be greeted with chocolate always seems to escape her. I told my commanding officer that you wouldn't go on a killing rampage, so it'd be nice if you could, you know, not do that.
Gabby groans.
You told them? Did you have to? The fact that she knows everything that gets told to Roy also gets told to Mace is a little creepy, considering he's never told her that.
They've kept every other secret of mine, he says dryly. I'm sure they'll keep this one, too.
Saif's eyes narrow, and his mouth presses into a thin line. Aviv puts the final touches on the makeup, then steps away. He says,
Trust Ed's judgment. It's never led us astray before.
He's an alchemist of the state, Saif growls. That is not one, but two strikes against him.
Aviv sighs.
He is a dear friend. Were I lost in the desert, I would trust him to carry my name to the highest mountain and speak it to the sun, so that Ishvala might know to welcome me home.
Saif blinks, nonplussed, and Ed can feel a flush rise high on his cheeks. Ishvalan bodies are ceremoniously burned, so that they can be sent to the sky to Ishvala. Ishvalans whose bodies are lost must have someone travel to the tallest peak and yell their name into the setting sun, so that Ishvala will know that they are coming and make room for them in heaven. There were not many mountains in the desert. It was a long journey, from days to weeks, and to be entrusted to carry someone's name to Ishvala was to be trusted with their soul, with their eternal afterlife. It's not a claim Aviv makes lightly, and the last of Saif's tension drains from his body.
If he can be trusted to carry your name, then I suppose he can be trusted with all else. For you are my brother's wife's brother, and as such, you are my brother, and we are of the same name.
Oh God, that meant that Saif would trust Ed to carry his name to Ishvala, just on Aviv's words. And if they didn't stop talking about name carrying, he's going to spontaneously combust. So, no serial killing then?
For now, Saif allows,
which Ed figures is as good as it's going to get.
There are more important matters at stake, such as that of Layla.
Gabby and Aviv turn to him, curious and eager. Aviv has a look of bottled desperation that makes Ed uncomfortable only because it looks a little bit too much like what he sees when he looks in the mirror. Layla is dead. That woman is not Layla.
She looks like her, he argues. She has my sister's face, and she knew me. I could tell she knew me.
Ed rubs a hand over his face. She's a body made in Layla's image, and she has many of Layla's memories, but it's not the same. If it looks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, then it's probably a duck, Ed, Gabby says, raising an eyebrow. What's the difference?
She doesn't have Layla's soul, he stresses.
Aviv rolls his eyes.
What is a soul? It is not so very important, is it? You got one for an arm. I would give more than my arm to have my sister back, he says in Ishvalan.
That's a question for the ages. What is a soul? While usually he loves getting into philosophical and technical arguments with Aviv, now is not the time. He doesn't respond in Ishvalan because he doesn't want to mess up and say the wrong thing, doesn't want to say anything he doesn't mean. It's not that simple, he says, preparing himself to explain just the bare outlines of human transmutation. Just enough so they understand what Layla's husband did and what it was he created.
won't say this out loud because it's kind of mean, but after an hour walking through Dublith, she can't help but think it's kind of boring. Rush Valley is so busy and bustling and demanding, and Rezimbul is farm country. There's always something happening there. Planting or harvesting, or a whole pasture of cows getting into someone's cornfield. Or a bunch of horses getting loose. And she and Al and Ed getting to go and collect them together, because they were the only ones who weren't busy with school or the harvest. Ed and Al could have used alchemy, and Winry could have used the sun on shiny metal to trick the horses into going where they wanted, but where was the fun in that? Instead, they'd borrowed three of Richardson's mares and spent half a day chasing down the dozen or so escaped horses, laughing and sweat-soaked. It's one of her favorite memories. It's one of the last memories she had from when all three of them were whole. Or maybe not whole. Her parents were dead by then. Trisha was dead by then. But the three of them were together and unbroken, and it seemed as if nothing could touch them, as if their happiness would be there in front of them forever, beautiful and unending. It's a child's thought, but back then, they were children, so it's all they had. Now they're this. Al stuck in armor, compassionate and warm and forced into a place of coldness, of numbness. Ed twisting himself inside and out because no shape feels like it belongs to him anymore, and too afraid to commit to any shape in particular. Then there's her. And when they were kids, she used to be the crybaby, the one who got scared, the one who was afraid of what it meant to be different and smart, who was afraid of what it meant to not be afraid. Sometimes it's exhausting being the only one of them with any sort of common sense. She's not like them. Her burdens aren't the same. They're not the kind of things that torture her. Or maybe she's just the kind of person who tortures herself with them. She carries the name Rockabel. She has to be the best automail mechanic because that's what it means to be a Rockabel. But she's not just a mechanic. She's a surgeon, too. And she's saved more lives than she's lost. But she's still lost them. She wonders who has more blood on their hands, her or Ed. His from killing, from defending, hers from people she couldn't save, who she wasn't smart enough or strong enough or fast enough to save. It doesn't matter that she's just 17, that she never attended any sort of official school, that she has no shiny degree to hang on her wall. She's a doctor. She took the same oaths as every other doctor, the ones that no one forces mechanics to take, and sometimes the weight of it threatens to make her stumble on her way down her path. She has blood on her hands, dead parents, a grandmother who won't live forever, best friends who threaten to tear themselves apart until there's nothing left, and nothing to shore her up but her own resolve. That's okay. She stole some of it from Ed and Al, after all. Alchemist, be thou for the people. Doctor, be thou for the people. Winry, be thou for the people. She'll never be an alchemist, doesn't want to be one, has better and more interesting things to learn than trying to memorize obscure symbolism to change a chemical state. She's going to build an automail heart one day. She doesn't have time for stuff like alchemy. Humanity can't rely on alchemy. Alchemists die, and so do their talents, and all the circles in the world can't make someone good at alchemy if they just aren't. But mechanics can leave behind blueprints. Winry's in this for the long game. She's in this for what she'll leave behind when she's gone, for the people she'll never meet and who will be born long after she's dead, who will walk around with her technology inside them. It's driving her crazy to be away from Rush Valley, to just wander around this boring, picture-perfect village when she could be building or sketching or any other number of things. But she said she'd wait for Al, so she will. She just hopes she doesn't go insane from boredom first.
"Are you lost, sugar?"
a smooth voice asks, and Winry's eyes snap upwards. She's standing in front of a bar, and there's a man leaning in the doorway,
ridiculous vest and sunglasses he doesn't need, a leer on his lips that she's tempted to smack off. But his teeth are too sharp unless he files them, and he's got a dark red tattoo on the back of his hand, one with a snake eating its own tail. She flickers her eyes up to the words painted across the front of the bar, and, wow, that's so not subtle. She doesn't feel bad about this at all. A devil's nest indeed. Al is going to be furious that she didn't wait for him, but she's got the homunculus they're looking for right in front of her, and she'd be an idiot to walk away from that. Nope, she says, curling her hair around her finger and biting her lower lip. She's glad she's wearing a skirt that shows off her legs, but there's no way for her to tug down her shirt without being obvious. Damn. What's a girl gotta do to get a drink around here? He smiles, almost too quick for her to catch it, before the leer is back in place and he's leaning over her, doing his best to look down her shirt. Why, a pretty thing like you? She's just gotta come inside. She's faking. He knows she's faking, and she knows that he knows that she's faking, and he knows that she knows that he knows that she's faking. There's a strange, not totally human collection of people inside the bar, and all their eyes are on her as soon as she walks in. She quirks an eyebrow and doesn't react at all. They haven't seen Strange until they've seen some of the livestock Ed has dropped off in Resimbul during his time with the military. People should really stop experimenting with chimeras. They never get it right. Except, looking around, someone clearly has. She's not an alchemist, but she is a doctor. She knows her biology. And these look like perfect mixes of human and animal. Nothing like what Tucker did to his wife and Nina. Nothing like what the remains of failed experiments have looked like in the past. But real, true human chimeras. This worries her. She hopes it was greed who made them, because if there's an alchemist running around with this type of skill that they don't know about, then that's not good.
What would the pretty lady like?
Greed practically purrs, stepping behind the bar. Winry smiles, beautiful and empty, and says, Oh, I couldn't possibly decide. You'll have to pick for me. I wouldn't want to be greedy. Someone lets out a bark of laughter. But Winry doesn't look away to see who it was. There's that flash of a smile again, almost too quick to see.
Sure thing, sugar. While I do that, why don't you tell me a story?
What kind of story? She asks, eyeing the multitude of liquors he's swirling together. She's already decided she's going to drink it. She doubts it's poisoned. If they wanted to kill her, they wouldn't need a drink to do it. If they wanted to kill her, she'd already be dead.
Al is going to be so mad.
How about the story of how a pretty young girl like you ends up in a place like this?
He leans against the counter, pressing his face too close to hers.
Looking for someone like me.
She refuses to be intimidated, leans in even closer instead of pulling away, until they're almost touching.
I guess I've just got a lust for travel.
They stay like that. For long, still moments, until Winry's contemplating kissing him just to get him to do something. But he's the one who breaks first, throwing his head back and laughing so loudly the whole pub seems to shake with it.
All right, I'll bite, he says. Why are you really here? What does lust have to do with it?
He presents her finished drink to her with a flourish, and she pouts until he sticks a jaunty umbrella on top.
I thought you'd never ask, she says, and has to resist the urge to wink.
Okay, maybe Doublelift isn't that boring, as long as you know where to go. For the first time, Alphonse is really glad his brother isn't with him right now. He has about 5 seconds to worry about teacher being bedridden before she springs to her feet and throws him out the window. He lets her beat on him until he figures out she's waiting for him to fight back, and fine, okay. He was prepared to take his punishment gracefully, to let teacher rage and scream and call him every awful name in the book for not listening to the very first lesson she tried to teach him. But if this is how she wants to play it, fine. He's not a kid anymore. He's barely even human anymore. They can fight if she wants to fight. He doesn't have to wait for a mortal body to respond. His moves are instantaneous and smooth. And he's had plenty of fights not with her, learned too much during his time traveling the country with his brother. But she still maintains the upper hand. Older and dying and furious, she can still beat him. Maybe that's the lesson she was trying to teach. Because when she finally flips Alphonse over her shoulder on his back, the sound of his metal body hitting the dirt around them, she pauses. He doesn't move to get up, her harsh breathing filling the silence between them. He wonders if it's over, if it's safe to stand. There's the sound of vomiting, and he twists his head enough to see her rubbing the blood from her mouth. Sig is hovering anxiously in the doorframe, but he knows better than to interfere. And Al wants to get up and go to her, wants to help her, but he knows better too, so he doesn't move. "Your mother or Edward?" she asks, still breathing too fast, voice wet from the blood stuck in her throat. He doesn't understand. "What? Did you lose your body trying to resurrect your mother or Edward?" "Mom," he says. Then the rest of what she's said catches up with him. "Brother isn't dead." She freezes, and Al scrambles to his feet, not wanting to have this conversation on the ground. "Excuse me?" "Brother isn't dead," he repeats. "Of course he isn't. We both performed the transmutation. Why would you even think, if brother were dead, I wouldn't be here?" And he means that in the literal sense, of course. If Ed hadn't been there to bind his soul to the armor, Al would have been swallowed by the gate. But it's more than that. Because if Edward were dead, Izumi is completely right. He'd violate every law known to man to get him back. But he wouldn't hold back his own soul. He'd give everything. Al would trade his life for his brother's before living without him, would rather have no life at all than a life as the last surviving Elric. Izumi's whole body slumps. Then she snaps her head up and barks. "Then where is he, Alphonse? You two are never apart." He stares at her for a long moment, then lets out a little laugh that filters its way through his armor. "Things have changed, teacher," he says. "We've changed. It's not so easy anymore." It almost feels blasphemous to call the days they spent here as children easy. Grueling alchemy studies and relentless physical training and their dead mother casting a shadow they never seemed to be able to step out of. But it was easier. Simpler. Kinder. "Well," she sighs, and Sig finally steps forward, offering his wife an arm for her to lean on. "You'd better tell me all about it." By the time Ed steps out of Aviv and Gabby's crumbling apartment, the sun's begun to set. He really hadn't intended to be there that long, but they couldn't stop asking questions, and he couldn't help but answer them. It doesn't feel like it did him a lick of good. Saif thinks Lust is some sort of corporeal ghost. Aviv is convinced she's still his sister. And Gabby would just very much like it if no one else died, please. He sympathizes with Gabby a lot. He sighs and cranes his neck to the sky, catching the pale edge of the moon over the edge of one of the taller buildings. He misses stars. There are no stars in Central, and he's been all over. He knows what the night sky looks like from almost every angle of Amstrass. The view from Rezimbul will always be his favorite, but the stars shine brightest over where Ishval used to be. There's a prickling along the back of his shoulders, one he's felt many times before, but could never understand. But he understands it now. "I know you're there," he says conversationally. "Please don't tell me you've been waiting outside this entire time." Lust bleeds out from the shadows, a lot closer than he thought she was. "It's my job to watch you, Edward." The thought of Lust standing outside as Ed talked to her brother and brother-in-law, Layla's brother and brother-in-law, is so sad that he immediately discards it. They're still convinced you're Layla. They want to see you. No, she says automatically. Ed really doesn't want one of them looking out the window or something and see the two of them standing there. So he starts walking, leading the way away from the quiet, dangerous stillness here to something less dangerous, louder, easier to get lost in. He leads them towards Canal Street, where no one they catch the eye of will remember what they look like in the morning.
It will only hurt them. I am not the woman Saif welcomed into his family. I am not the sister Aviv grew up with. Seeing her face on me won't make it any easier on them.
Both of his eyebrows go to his hairline. That's oddly compassionate for a being with no soul, with no sense of compassion. She snorts and doesn't react when Ed laces their fingers together as they get closer to the seedier parts of Central. Lust is too beautiful for people not to look at, and too powerful for anyone to be any danger to her. But Ed figures his hand in hers will dissuade at least some people from getting too close.
I don't need to have compassion to know the shape of it, Edward.
That makes him think of what Gabby said about ducks, and he's not gonna phrase it exactly like that, because Lust wouldn't understand it if he did. You know, pretending to be compassionate and actually being compassionate is indistinguishable from an outside perspective.
Perhaps, she says, wary. What's your point?
Maybe humanity works the same way, he says, watching her. Well aware she could crush the bones of his hand to dust if she wanted to. Maybe pretending to be human and actually being human isn't all that different. Because I've met some monstrous humans, okay? And you seem a lot more human than they did, even though you're not one. Except maybe you are. Maybe not just like us, but still one of us. It's just pretending to be human and actually being human is indistinguishable from an outside perspective. She's not angry. He thought she might be, but she just looks tired.
You sound like greed.
Well, maybe he's a smart guy. She lets out a sharp laugh.
He is, but we'll see if you still feel that way when you meet him. What's your point, Edward? What are you trying to get at here?
Okay, here's the part she might really crush his hand for. He really should have used his automail hand to hold hers. It's at least easier to fix than his flesh one. I told you I'd help you, and I will. I'll figure out a way for you to get, well, if it's not Layla's soul, a soul. Or something close enough to one that you won't know the difference. But in the meanwhile, are you trying to prevent them from getting hurt or you? She stops walking, but his hand is still intact.
Why would you say that?
She asks, and she's closing herself off. But she's not running, not fighting. She's still here, letting him hold her hand in a crowded street. Pretending to be human and actually being human are indistinguishable from an outside perspective. So Aviv and Saif aren't gonna care that you're not like them, that you're a homunculus. Because even though you don't have all the memories, don't have all the feelings that go with them, you know you care. Or at least you know you should care. And you're not Layla, but you look like her and talk like her and remember so much of what she remembered. And if you want to talk to her brother and her brother's husband, I don't think they're the ones that are at the most risk of getting hurt. He swallows, and she's looking at him, dark eyes that should be red, wide and unmoving. I just don't think you should have to wait to be whole before you try and be happy. Izumi lets her husband fuss over her, drinks the tea he brings, and lets him arrange the blankets over her legs. Sitting in bed doesn't do her much good. Not really, but it makes Sig feel better. Stops Alphonse from twisting his hands together. So she lets them worry. Then she forces Al to sit at the end of her bed, and she listens. If it were anyone else telling her these things, about any other people, she wouldn't believe a word. But it's Alphonse telling her,
and he and Edward who did so many impossible things. And of them, and from them, are the only people she could believe this about. Her heart is strong. It wasn't one of the many organs affected by her attempt at human transmutation. But it squeezes painfully in her chest the longer Al talks. And Sig is sitting quietly, knowing that alchemy isn't a subject he knows enough about. But her husband's face is getting more thunderous with each passing word. Human transmutation, they'd guessed. But the rest of it? The military, Ed's rank, bending the laws of alchemy to save an unsavable little girl, homunculi, and how they're born? She killed and buried the thing she made. The thing that wasn't her son. And she'd spent years wondering if she made the right choice. But now she knows she did. The thing she made didn't look human, because it wasn't one. And a plot to end all of Amstress, and the monster who calls himself Father behind it all. When Al tells her of the homunculi named Greed that he needs to find for reasons he won't get into, only that it will get the homunculi he calls Sloth on their side somehow, she's almost relieved. That sounds the easiest to accomplish from his list of impossible tasks. And there has to be a good reason that Ed didn't come with him. A good reason that Ed sent his precious little brother to do something so uncertain and dangerous alone. But Izumi can't think of what it would be. Alphonse is quiet for a long moment, shifting nervously, an odd scraping sound as his metal body rubs together with his every restless movement. Then he squares his shoulders and tells her that Ed remembers everything from the gate, that he carries that knowledge, and she has to press a hand to her mouth to keep from vomiting. Remembering that she knew it once is enough to give her nightmares. The simple act of having seen it is, and the ghostly imprints that it leaves behind is enough to do alchemy without circles. But to have all that terrible, horrible knowledge, to have more than an afterimage, sounds unbearable. "Brother is different now," Al says, quiet. "Maybe it's not because of the gate. I'm different now, too, and I don't remember any of it. Maybe we just grew up." "You really don't remember anything?" she asks, putting aside her horror for now. It hasn't warped Ed too badly, hasn't crushed him, hasn't left him vacant and empty. Al would know if it had. Al knows his brother better than anyone. And if Ed had been swallowed by the knowledge of the gate, he would have noticed. He shakes his head. I wish I did. I know it's not nice. I know it's about the farthest thing from nice that there is. But I still wish I didn't need circles. It seems almost pointless to survive something so horrible and not even get alchemy without circles from it. But every time I bring up trying to remember, Brother gets upset. He worries that it will be too much. That what happened to him will happen to me. But I don't think it will. Ed gave up his ignorance as part of his equivalent exchange, but I didn't. Izumi wants to agree with Ed, wants to say it's not worth the risk, that it's not worth it. But these boys are talking about starting a war. Or, not exactly. They're talking about strangling a war, about cutting off the head of the snake before it can strike. And with something so large, so delicate and important, she doesn't think they can afford not to take advantage of whatever they can. "I think you should try and remember. It's terrible, but you already know many terrible things, and I'd rather you have the extra safety that alchemy without circles gives you." In his solemn, sad silence, Izumi realizes she's not telling him anything that he doesn't already know. "I won't go behind Ed's back to do it," he says. "I know I have to do it, that I can't afford not to, whether Ed approves or not, but I won't lie to him, and I won't do it without him." Al said that he and his brother have changed, and made it sound like it wasn't for the better, like they had become worse than they were, less than they were. But looking at the fear and determination and loyalty present in every line of Al's body, Izumi doesn't think that's the case. She remembers them as children, how tightly they clung to each other at the possibility of losing everything else, at how it seemed at times as if they shared one body, one mind, how they would cry when the other was hurt, and how, together, they'd draw the most complex, beautiful circles she'd ever seen, without even having to speak. This is different. More adult. Healthier, even. More than anything else, it tells Izumi that Alphonse really has grown up. And she digs her nails into the skin of her palms to keep her eyes from watering. She wants to tell him this. To tell him that, under all her disappointment and anger and fear, that she's proud of him. But before she gets the chance, her door bangs open, slamming off her back wall, unfamiliar silhouettes crowding into her doorframe. She and Sig have already gotten to their feet, ready to fight. The first one steps inside, and it's a tall man in a vest with a pretty young blonde woman being held bridal style in his arms. "Found him!" the girl says, voice coming out loud and slurred. She's got an arm around the exasperated man's shoulders to keep her balance.
"Found your stupid homunculus! Let's go!"
"Winry?" Alphonse asks cautiously, hands just twitching to reach for her. Izumi blinks and looks closer. And this young woman must be the girl she met once so long ago when she passed through Rezimbul. Al and Ed's best friend.
"What are you talking about? Who are these people?"
He tilts his head to the side.
"Are you drunk?"
"Your girl has no alcohol tolerance at all," the man says.
Winry blows him a raspberry and sticks her nose into the air.
This is greed. And his friends. His friends are coming too."
"They're not my friends."
The man, apparently Greed, the deadly and ancient homunculus, says, pained,
"They're my minions."
They're also perfectly formed human chimeras from the looks of it, and if Izumi had any doubts about the mess Al has gotten himself into before, she doesn't anymore.
"Don't say that about your friends! It's not nice!"
Winry lectures. The deadly and scary homunculus only rolls his eyes and doesn't do more than huff in irritation when she accidentally elbows him in the face trying to twist around.
"Can I have a piggyback ride to the train station?"
Al doesn't have any expressions, but it's clear as day that he's extremely nervous and uncomfortable about this whole situation.
"Winry, maybe we should just pause for a second. We don't need to leave right now."
"Yes, we do,"
she yells, and Greed flinches when she does it right in his ear. He finally gets sick of her fumbling attempts and twists around so she's on his back. Her legs around his waist and her arms are around his neck. He holds her in place, still trying to pretend he's cool and unaffected, even though a teenage girl is using him as a jungle gym.
"Ed's in trouble, and he's alone, and Greed said that father is danger... that he's bad, and we have to hurry."
She's wonderfully focused for a girl who's so drunk she can't even stand on her own.
"The kid's right," Greed says. "If Lust is making moves against father, then she needs all the help she can get. And the same goes for your brother. We need to be on the next train to Central."
Izumi is startled when Winry slides off Greed's back, swaying for a moment, before finding her footing and marching over to her. She puts her fists on her hips and looks her straight in the eye, and she's amused to notice the little girl she remembers is now the same height as her.
"I figure some of this is your fault,"
Winry tells her, and Izumi wants to be angry, but she doesn't say it like an accusation. She says it like a fact, like there's nothing to be done but accept it.
"So, are you gonna come with us or not?"
She shouldn't. It's not safe. Not with her health. But she's been dying for years, and this is the first thing that proves to be interesting, that might actually be worth her time, worth her death.
"Yeah,"
she says, mouth tugging into a grin, deciding she likes this drunk, focused girl who found a homunculus in half a day and made friends with him in less than that, who looks her in the eye and doesn't flinch away from whatever she sees there. "I'm coming." Lust stares at him for a long moment, and Ed wonders if he's about to get a gutful of knives for his trouble. Then she quirks her lips at the corners. All right, I'll talk to Aviv and Saif if you make a move on Mustang. The stomach full of knives would have hurt less. Excuse me? If I don't have to wait until I'm whole to be happy, then neither do you, she says, flicking his automail shoulder. You can't think he'll reject you. He loves you. How would you know? He snarls, then immediately regrets it. But she doesn't get angry at him. Instead, her face goes soft. Something it shouldn't be capable of. Something she shouldn't be capable of if she's really as heartless as she thinks she is. I remember how my husband looked at Layla. He loved her. Of course he loved her. He was stupid enough to try and save her and got me instead, but... I've never been whole, Edward. Half Ishvalan with dark Amstrian hair. He still loved me. Her. You and Mustang. It's the same thing. She pokes at his metal arm again. Half Ishvalan, half metal. What difference does it make? We are not the bodies we inhabit. Your husband? He echoes, ignoring the issue of Roy. Because Lust is right, and he knows she's right, and it terrifies him. What he and Roy could have terrifies him. I thought you didn't have a husband, that you weren't Layla. Her face saddens, and he wants to take it back, but he can't. I'm not, she says. I'm not Layla. I wish I was, but wishing I was her will do me about as much good as you wishing that you had your body back. None at all. He still thinks you're her, he says. Aviv thinks you're his sister. Ed can't even blame him. If he were to lose Al, and then someone with his face and memories appeared, he would know better, but he still doesn't think he could help getting the two confused. Could help wanting him anyway. I'm not, she says firmly. Then, but if I'm all of her that's left, and... All I am is Layla, and a monster. That's what I'm made of. And I don't want to be a monster anymore, Edward. Then you won't be one, he decides. Then asks, only half-teasing, Should I call you Layla now? She shakes her head, eyes wide. No, don't. No, absolutely not. That's too much. Too much like trying to crawl into her skin and calling it my own. It's not the same. We're not the same. Okay, Ed says, and doesn't argue with her. She's right, but it's hurting her that she's not Layla, that she can't feel happiness or love or affection, that she can't experience the good that Layla experienced. And so she's not Layla. People aren't purely made of pain and torment. Tell me more about this plot to destroy Amstress. I should probably start working on that, I guess. She flashes a smile at him, and she knows what he's doing, but she doesn't stop him, and she starts talking. This meeting hadn't been planned, so they hadn't intended for it to be anything besides casual. So they walk through Canal Street, arm in arm, to exchange information and to get solid footing with all of this. Ed's almost been enjoying himself, even, because Lust is a lot less scary when she isn't shish kebabbing random people. He wonders if people think the same sort of thing about him, actually. They leave Canal Street eventually, heading away from the main hub to one of Central's many secluded alleys, where there's no one to overhear them but the rats. Constantly moving through the hustle and bustle of a crowded street is good. It means no one's paying attention to them, and those that are can't catch more than a few words. But there's something to be gained by silence, by being able to stop and look each other in the eye. Besides, when discussing which of the military brass are loyal to Pride and therefore Father, even a few words overheard could be devastating. You're probably going to want to write this down, Lust says, leaning against the wall and stretching her arms above her head. That many? Ed asks, and wishes he could be surprised. There was a reason everyone from granny to teacher thought the military was rotten down to its core. The couple of good officers he'd managed to find hadn't changed that. Lust opens her mouth to answer, but instead a hauntingly familiar voice says,
"Well, what do we have here? It looks like you must have been a very bad girl, Lust."
Ed feels all the blood drain from his face. Lust moves, shoving him behind her and letting her terrifying hands extend into claws.
"What are you doing here?"
A face Ed had never expected to see again steps out of the shadows.
"Father was worried when you didn't come home last night. You shouldn't make Father worry."
"Mom?" he asks, voice high and trembling, and the tears he's holding back making his eyes blurry. Sloth flinches back and snaps, "I'm not your mother."
"You look like her."
And he should stop talking. He's sure he's only making her angrier. But she does look like his mother. Has her hair and her face and God, but his mom was young. She seemed so old when they were kids, so mature. But his mom was only 19 when she had him, and only 26 when she died. Roy is older now than his mother was, and God, but his mom had been too young to die. Too young to be raising two sons all on her own.
"Like that matters," she says, and it's his mother's voice, but he's never heard her sound so contemptuous before. "Envy can look like however he chooses. That doesn't mean that's what he is."
"Sloth," Lust says.
"Calm down. Let's talk about this."
She sneers. "Talk about what? You broke the rules. You talked to the sacrifice. Now it's time for the both of you to die." Then her entire body goes liquid, and it's surging towards them. Edward claps his hands and drops to the ground, boxing them into the alley, which is probably a horrible idea for his continued survival, but will hopefully keep this fight away from civilians. Lust knocks through Sloth, and it's apparently jarring enough that Sloth regains her shape. Lust stalks forward and pierces her through the chest with her razor-sharp fingers. When she pulls them out, blood comes pouring out.
"No," Ed says. "Don't hurt her."
"She's trying to kill us, Edward," Lust snaps, jamming her other hand into Sloth's stomach. "What do you care?" Sloth asks, eyes sick with hatred. Blood drips out of her mouth, and just the sight of it leaves him reeling, brings him back to when he was a kid and his mom would have horrible coughing fits that would end with blood in her hand and dripping over her lips. "You left me to die. If Lust kills me, she'll just be finishing what you started." Lust snarls and twists her hand, causing Sloth's face to spasm in pain before she shifts backwards, enough to escape, and then punching Lust so hard that it breaks her neck, and her head rolls disconcertingly to the side of her shoulder as she steps back. That would spell immediate death for any human, but Lust is no human.
"Edward, she may be your mother, but that doesn't mean she won't kill you."
"I'm not his mother!" Sloth screeches, and she's still bleeding from all the wounds Lust gave her. Except Ed's looking closer, and it doesn't look exactly like blood. It's too thin. Ed's eyes widen. It's not blood. It's red water. Whatever Lust is doing isn't just hurting her. It's drawing the red water out. She's starting the detox process even as she's fighting for their lives. Ed is so grateful that he and Lust are on the same side. Lust has just fused her skull back onto her spine when Lust rushes forward. Lust tries to stop her, her nails growing outward and attempting to skewer her, but it fails. Sloth goes liquid, then jams her hands into Lust's stomach and tears open her abdomen. Even Lust can't help but scream at that. "You're the one talking to him. You're the one so pathetic as to act like the sacrifice's mother." Ed startles at that. It sounds almost like...
"Are you jealous?"
Lust asks, managing to laugh, even as Sloth digs her hand into the mess of her abdomen and crushes her spine in her grip.
"Don't worry. I've been dealing with my own family drama. I have no need to intrude on yours." You don't have a family, Sloth hisses. And it's so strange for Ed to hear cruelty in his mother's voice. He's never heard it before. Lust takes a step forward, pushing Sloth back. And it's really uncomfortable for Ed to see Lust's internal organs just falling out of her body and disintegrating into the ground. Watching them grow back and fall all over again is even worse. You're right. I don't have a family. Do you know why? Because I'm not Layla. I'm not the woman that I was created to replace. But you are. Sloth is shaking her head and backing away. Lust doesn't let her get far, stalking her and moving closer as her body slowly knits itself back together. You're a wife and a daughter and a mother. Shut up! Sloth seethes, eyes wide. You don't know what you're saying! Lust is keeping her distracted, and Ed knows it won't last. Knows that Sloth is frustrated and angry enough that she's not being as deadly as she could be, as destructive as she could be. And they're way too close to bustling civilian streets for that. So he kneels down and closes his eyes, clapping his hands together. He hasn't had a chance to test this, and it's delicate enough that he really would have preferred to draw the circle out, to double-check his angles and equations. But he also would have preferred to not have been ambushed in the middle of the night by a homunculus, so he guesses he'll just have to work with what he has. He separates his hands and presses them to the ground, hoping this works. Alchemical energy crackles to life, a soft blue light rising from the ground and surrounding Sloth in a tight circle, so he doesn't accidentally get Lust as well. Sloth realizes what's happening too late and tries to run out of the circle of blue, crackling light. She can't leave. She lunges against it, but it's like a fly battering against glass. She's not going anywhere.
Well, look what we have here.
Lust practically purrs, absently sticking the rest of her organs back inside her so her abdomen fuses shut again. Her skin clear and unmarked, nothing to show she'd ever been hurt to begin with.
Looks like you won't be killing anyone.
Sloth snarls, and seeing that look of frustrated defeat on his mother's face pulls at him, and he hates that he had to be the one to put it there. Lust, don't. She rolls her eyes and steps back. Sloth's eyes finally find him, and he can't move, doesn't know what to do with his mother's eyes on him. What do you care? She asks. Aren't you going to finish what you started? You should have killed me when you made me. I would have died easier then. No, he says, and he forces himself to walk forward. He stands just outside the containment circle, searching for any imperfection, any difference between her and the woman he remembers. Lust doesn't look just like Layla, and apparently none of the other homunculi look just like the people they were meant to replace. But Sloth does. She looks exactly like Trisha Elric. Are you crying? She demands, and she's trying to sound cruel, but it doesn't come out just right. Mourning the woman you failed to bring back before you kill me? He touches his face, and he's surprised to find it wet. He hadn't known he was crying. I'm not going to kill you, he says. I could never... No, I'm not going to do that. Why not? You left me to die. It's the same thing. Or do you just not want to get your hands dirty? Will you have Lust do it then?
We didn't know, he whispers.
And from the way surprise ripples across her face, he knows she heard him.
We didn't. We thought we failed. We didn't know. And then when Al went back for you, you were gone. And we thought you dissolved, that you couldn't hold the form, and you just returned to the gate.
His breath is hitching, and he's really crying now, and it's a struggle to keep it under control.
I wouldn't. We would never, okay? Mom, we didn't know.
It doesn't feel real, being trapped in this circle and watching Ed cry. This seems like a trick, or a dream, or maybe a nightmare. How many times did she fantasize about this exact moment? When Father first took her, she was so sure it wouldn't last, that her children would come for her, that they would come to take her home. As her memories cleared and settled, She remembered Ed crying for his brother. Remembered all the blood as his limbs were torn away. Remembered Al carrying his brother away. So she contented herself to wait. Her children were hurt. They would need time to recover. And it was only right that they should heal themselves before they came for her. She wouldn't want them to get hurt, to get more hurt, after all. But Father kept forcing her to drink red water, and the years passed, and still no one came for her. Still her sons didn't come for her. The more red water she consumed, and the more time passed with no signs that her sons even cared about her, the angrier she became. "You didn't know I was alive," she asks, and her head feels funny. She should have thought of that before. Why did she never think of that before? She was a screaming pile of flesh and bone, and then she was gone, and no one else had done it before. Why would they assume they had? Why hadn't she gone to them? Father only kept her close those first couple of years. After that, she could have gone back to Rezimbul, could have talked to them herself. "No," Ed says, "her firstborn, her precious child. She spent 20 hours in labor to bring him into the world. Mom, I swear, if we'd known, nothing could have stopped us from coming for you. We risked everything to get you back, gave up so much to have you. We wouldn't have done that if we didn't love you." "Your leg," she says, and she's always known that Ed lost his leg. Of course, but it didn't matter before now. "Oh, your arm. No, you shouldn't have done it. I wasn't worth the risk. I was dead. Dead things should stay dead. And now you only have half your limbs, and Alphonse is in armor, and no, I never wanted any of this." She's always known, knew what it meant, but it never mattered to her before. And she can't think as to why. Can't think of why it didn't matter before or why it matters now. She's lightheaded and she stumbles, falling to her knees inside the circle. "Mom, are you okay?" She's kneeling in red water. Where did it come from? Did it come from her? She doesn't feel well. She should drink it. Whenever she doesn't feel well, Father gives her more to drink. "Stop." She looks up and Lust is glaring at her. "Don't drink it. Withdrawal symptoms are starting, and it's going to suck, but you can't drink it." "But..." She looks down at the water in her cupped hands. "But it hurts." Ed claps his hands, and the barrier is gone. Lust is yelling at him, but he's not listening. He grabs her wrists and pulls them apart, so her precious red water falls back to the ground. "Don't," he says, eyes puffy and red from crying. "I know it hurts, and it's gonna hurt more, but don't, please." She frowns, her vision going blurry at the corners as a vicious pain rips through her abdomen, something sharp and twisting inside her. "You have to be sure," she says, reaching up to cup her son's face. "If I do this, you have to be sure you want me. I'm still a monster. I'm not the mother you lost." "It doesn't matter," he says, laying his hand on top of hers and leaning into her touch. "You may not be the mother we lost, but we're not the same sons who lost you either. I've done such awful things, Mom." He bites his lip and tries to smile, and it doesn't look quite right. "If anyone's the monster, I think it's me. So we fit, if anything, one big monstrous family." The pain is worse. It's so bad that she's panting, and it's spreading. Soon her whole body will feel like this. But she can't pass out. Not yet. This is important. "You're not a monster," she says firmly. "You're my son." Ed's crying again, and she reaches out to brush his tears away, just like she used to when he was a kid, and oh, he's so grown up. She's missed so much of her son's lives. "Ed, Sloth, we have to go," Lust says. "We have to get her somewhere safe soon. Once the withdrawal symptoms really start, she'll start lashing out. She won't be able to help it. We have to be somewhere secure when that happens. Ed nods, pushing himself to his feet. She tries to stand, but can't. Her legs won't listen to her. Ed bends down and picks her up, an arm against her back and under her knees. He's so strong. She can feel a fresh wave of tears crawling their way up her throat, and she has to swallow before she can speak again. "My name's not Sloth," she says, trying to hold unconsciousness at bay just a few more moments. "Julia, sorry, we have to go," Lust says, looking worried. "I don't know if it will be worse or better for you than it was for me, but we can't be here when we find out." She shakes her head, then leans it against Ed's shoulder when it makes everything spin around her. Everything's going dark, and her mouth feels mushy and hard to move. But she has to say this, has to get it out. "That's not my name. It's Trisha. I'm Trisha Elric."